Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Among the conversations today, playwright Desi Gallegos will talk about his one-man show at the Marsh, God Fights the Plague. We'll be talking with Christopher White and Madeline H.D. Brown from Mugwumpin. We'll also hear about the eponymous Smith Wymore Disappearing Acts. They're doing a new piece at Counterpulse this week, and we'll get an overview of the Frameline Film Festival. Plus, Peter Robinson is in with a review of modernism and a film review. Stay with us. Performance and theater artist, puppeteer, musician, and writer Chris White is co-founder of and artistic director of Mugwumpin. Now in its 10th year, Mugwumpin, if you haven't caught them, is a San Francisco-based ensemble that devises collective live art that takes artistic risk and emphasizes physicality, playfulness, and precision. Among other credits, Chris has also designed puppets and directed puppetry for SF Playhouse and worked in Ireland for a stint at Project Arts Center in Dublin. Chris, welcome back to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
He's joined in studio by fellow Mugwumpin Company member, Madeline H.D. Brown. She's a San Francisco-based performer whose focus is collaborating on and performing in just this sort of Mugwumpin mania. Before landing in the Bay Area, she traveled as a cabaret performer in Europe. Professional study was at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and something we'll have to talk about, a 3-year diploma in corporeal mime from the International School of Corporeal Mime. In addition to Mugwumpin, Madeline is a member of Hatch, a festival of devised performance, and a co-founding member of Psycho Pomp and Circumstance Dance Theater. A pleasure to welcome you as well, Madeline.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to also realize that you were once a poster girl for Noir City, as you're admiring our poster here.
It's absolutely true.
Now, for those unfamiliar with Mugwumpin, let's get an encapsulation of how you guys started. And first of all, how did you get that title? Maybe Chris can handle that.
Well, I mean, honestly, it was a little bit of an accident. I founded the company with two of my classmates from grad school, and we really enjoyed making work together in grad school and decided to see what it was like to make it out there in the real world. And we moved to San Francisco and started making a show, but we decided we needed to market it under some kind of name. And honestly, I don't remember where I came across the word mugwump, but it just felt really good in our mouths. And we decided that rather than just sticking an S at the end to make it plural, we would put on an IN at the end to make it plural. And it also sounded like an activity, maybe, you know, we're just hanging around Mugwumpin. And it stuck. And actually, it's only been since then that we've really understood the sort of rich history of the word mugwump from, you know, back in the turn of the century and from Naked Lunch, and the mugwump also makes an appearance in Harry Potter novels.
All right, so it's got some history, as do you now. 10 years in the making. Fantastic.
10 years, yeah.
That must be an opportunity to look back a little bit, maybe reassess the mission statement or revisit it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we're constantly trying to re-envision what we do and keep evolving as we're working. And, I mean, you know, we recognize that there's an arbitrariness to the 10th anniversary. We just happen to have 10 fingers and toes. So, but it also does feel like something of a milestone. And it is an opportunity to look back at the work that we've made so that we can figure out where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Madeline, how long have you been involved with Mugwumpin?
I think I've been a member since around 2010 when I moved to San Francisco. It was 2007, and my first theatrical job in town was in 2008 with Mugwumpin. So I've been playing with them since 2008, but I think officially I'm one Mugwump since 2010.
Do you get a tattoo or something after a certain point? Or?
We can't show them to you, unfortunately.
It's radio. Of course you can.
Maybe 20th anniversary.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, one of the things that's commemorating the 10th anniversary is the work 10 Years by 10 Artists in 10 Minutes at the ACT Costume Shop on the 7th of July. Tell us a little bit about that event.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we want to do is that we really recognize that we're part of this amazing community of performers across theater and dance and, you know, the drag scene here in San Francisco. And we really wanted to sort of highlight that community within the context of our 10th celebration. So we just invited 10 artists who we really admire, but most of whom we actually haven't had the chance to work with before, and invited them to make a 10-minute piece that sort of reflects their past 10 years in the Bay Area. And then we're going to show them all on one single night. And we actually have no idea what they're going to be. There's going to be some drag in there. There's going to be a video piece. There's going to be some dance, some theater. It should be a really, really fun night.
Nice. Now, are you both involved in the show called This Is All I Need, which explores the question of whether we're a nation of collectors or hoarders?
We are indeed. We are both in that show. We created it and did it in a workshop in 2010 and then presented it in its full glory that fall. And so now we're remounting it. And I think the answer is we're all collectors and hoarders, perhaps, is what we're understanding on some level or other, whether it's stuff or stuff inside of us or trying to figure out what to do with our stuff.
So how does that show take shape?
Well, mostly...
Or has it yet?
Oh, it definitely has.
All right, yes.
It's, as a show about stuff, it's definitely our most prop-heavy show that we've ever done. And the props really take over the stage. And at moments, we just have to lean back and let them do their work. And it's really fascinating, though, to revisit this piece now 4 years after we made it, because it is still so incredibly resonant and perhaps even more so as the culture in San Francisco continues to change. And I mean, we find that the context of the show, there's a beautiful monologue that Madeline delivers about her dream of taking Mission Cinema and transforming it into this amazing art center. And the way that resonates today versus how it did when we made it is very much more poignant, I think.
So does the show explore the struggle between hoarding and collecting, or what are the characters are involved in the show?
Well, we have an interesting mix of texts and interviews that we've collected from friends and associates and people we've happened to meet, and also pieces that we've written. So I wrote the piece about the Mission Cinema dream, and you can see how all of these narratives wind with each other in ways that we wouldn't necessarily expect, and how items like bowling balls and bowling pins and wooden boxes and strawberry crates actually become really poignant servitors of moments that we all experience with needing our stuff around us to tell us who we are and what we're about.
Mm. And I think that there are sort of two poles to that for us. There is the sort of end of the spectrum that I think tilts towards keeping our stuff around us to protect us from our anxieties of contemporary life. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, which is our possessions being sort of repositories for emotional memory that, you know, have a great deal of meaning and resonance for us. And those things, you know, it's everything along the gamut that an object can contain both of those poles within it.
Mm-hmm. And so that's just one element of what's going on with Mugwumpin over
which
these next several weeks.
Which I do want to mention that This Is All I Need begins performances this very evening at the ACT Costume Shop and runs through Sunday. And then we also have another show that we are remounting called Super Anti-Reluctant, which opens next week. And these two shows are running in rep, so they alternate weekends through July 13th.
Mm-hmm. That's Chris White, co-founder of Mugwumpin, talking also with Madeline H.D. Brown, a Mugwumpin company member. Now, tell us a little bit about, we talked about the shows that are in rep, but what are the Mugwumpin occurrences?
Well, our occurrences are, it's something that we've been doing now since, actually, I think since 2010, that they are our sort of experimental performance pieces for non-theater spaces. And we started doing them because we had a lot of ideas of how performance might live out in the world, or how we might be able to relate to our audiences, but that the expectations that people come into a theater with didn't really serve those ideas. So the occurrences gave us a chance to play with those ideas out where the kinds of expectations that people bring to the table are wide open. And so there are three occurrences that we're doing, which are all brand new pieces that are pointing to works that we have in development right now. So there is a piece, for example, that was performed this week, where one of our associates, Stephanie DeMott, was collecting stories around Lake Merritt. And that is sort of pointing to a story project that is in development to happen at Children's Fairyland in Oakland next year. And so we've got three different occurrences that are happening in sort of hidden places around the city. And I recommend that people go to our website, mugwumpin.org, to find out more information about those.
Sure. I'd like you to touch on as well some symposiums that are happening. You're involved with a couple of them, Chris. Yeah. One especially intriguing title, Your Chocolate in My Peanut Butter. What's that all about?
Well, it's really thinking about the way Mugwumpin really sort of lives in a nexus place of performance. We have a lot of movement in our work, and sometimes it looks almost more like dance than theater. Often it looks much more like theater than dance. It also, you know, sometimes people stick performance art on what we do. And we find that a lot of times these worlds in San Francisco are kind of siloed from each other, and I think that that's to the detriment of all of us. And so it's not necessarily, yes, I want to touch upon working across disciplines with artists that we're not used to working with, but also how the performance communities in San Francisco can start to think of themselves as a performance community that can all support each other.
Very nice. And Madeline, what other aspects of Mugwumpin are you involved in with this several weeks that are coming up here?
That is a great question. I think I'm generally a cheerleader and support and showing up and helping to be a liaison with public who maybe haven't encountered us before and chat with them about Mugwumpin. I will be out at the occurrences, popping in and out of the salon and symposiums. There's fabulous workshops coming up that I'm really looking forward to seeing people contribute to and learn from. And I was particularly excited about a salon we just had this past Monday, which was the kickoff event for Mugwumpin 10. And we brought some friends of ours from Detroit. I dragged half of Mugwumpin to Detroit in March to meet some fabulous artists. And we Chris actually got a host of people, a wonderful company from Detroit, to come down for the salon this past Monday, where we got to talk about place and performance, including friends from Detroit, folks from New York, and folks from the San Francisco Bay Area. So besides This Is All I Need, I'm out and about like a butterfly.
Yeah, good for you.
And I do want to highlight what Madeline just said about the workshops that we have coming up. They're running every Sunday from 10 to 2, and they really touch on a lot of collaborative performance making practices that we've developed over the past 10 years. And for anybody who's interested in those, they should check out our website, mugwumpin.org, and find out more about those.
And Chris, maybe just briefly about what's happening in August. I understand there's quite a commission work for the Asian Art Museum, of installation performance piece?
Yes. So the Asian Art Museum is just opening an exhibit called Gorgeous, and it's a collaboration with the SF MoMA, because of course SF MoMA is being renovated right now. And it's a really interesting mix of works from both of their collections. And so they asked Mugwumpin to come in and create some sort of performance experience to help bridge for the for their audience these two different worlds that they're presenting in the exhibit. So we'll really be asking audiences to interrogate and think about their aesthetic perceptions of what beauty and gorgeousness is in a very interactive kind of way, but it's totally opt-in and not scary at all. So I encourage people to come Saturdays in August to check that out.
And more information about that at mugwumpin.org as well. Chris White, thanks so much for coming in today. Madeline H.D. Brown, I look forward to seeing you, and This Is All I Need.
Thanks. David.
We'll see you again soon. Again, mugwumpin.org for all Mugwumpin mania that's going to be happening this month and next, as well as August at the Asian Art Museum. heavy emphasis on today's open air about performing arts and things that are happening in the very near future here in the Bay Area. We'll be hearing also from Peter Robinson about the film Chef and a review of modernism at the De Young. Young playwright Desi Gallegos will also be in to talk about his one-man show at The Marsh. We'll get an overview of Frameline before the hour is out, so stay with us. It's going to be a quick hour. My next guests, Lisa Wymore and Sheldon B. Smith, are founders of Smith Wymore Disappearing Acts. They'll have a performance premiere of their work Number Zero, a space opera, at Counterpulse tomorrow. For their newest work, they enter the realm of science fiction, and one of the characters is a computer operating system created and programmed by Sheldon and one of the other performers. Lisa and Sheldon have a great sense of humor, and it's a pleasure to welcome them onto our show for a discussion of Disappearing Acts and Number Zero. Lisa Wymore is also an associate professor of dance and director of the dance program within the Department of Theater, Dance, and Performance at UC Berkeley. Teaches courses in choreography, contemporary dance technique, performance, movement, improvisation as well. Lisa, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And Sheldon has been making dances, music, and video art for over 25 years in both the Midwest and California. Originally trained and ballet and French horn, but has since come to his senses.
That's right.
Cross-disciplinary would be an apt moniker with a heavy dose of technology integration. Sheldon, welcome to Open Air as well.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. Now, I think we're all familiar of the use of tech and how important tech is in the actual display and presentation of the performing arts, but you're going a step further and involving it as one of the performers.
Yeah, I think we got to a certain point in our work where tech was, tech had always had kind of a personality anyway in everything we were doing. And it was never enough for us to just use technology as a way of creating spectacle. And so we started to just think more deeply about how the technology in a work is a kind of actor in its own right. Mm-hmm. And so we just decided to really go for it and see if, I mean, similarly to the movie Her, which we've avoided actually watching while we're doing this work, we decided to just create a piece in which there really is a deep interaction between the technology informing a lot of what goes on in the performance. So the computer is actually telling the performers in real time during the performance what to do, and we don't always know what that's going to be from one night to the next.
That's quite an evolution then from night to night.
It is.
Yeah.
So how is that changing night to night? Why is the computer changing?
So it we were also really interested in involving more improvisation in our work, just both dance improvisation, but performance improvisation in general, and had been thinking about how technology could help, while we're improvising, give us information that we can use in the improvisational process. And those ideas eventually sort of have evolved into something that's more of a narrative now about this kind of somewhat mean-spirited computer that is not just telling us what to do, but killing off some of the performers, just doing very odd things to us throughout.
Giving us different directions to engage with one another as we're on the stage.
Uh-huh.
So the computer plays between being kind of this collaborator, but at times then being a dictator and telling the performers to move in different directions or to do different tasks or engage with different improvisational scores. So we were just really interested in that kind
of
power play.
So it's a randomization that the computer's providing.
It's, I think a point of reference that certainly some people would have with just Cunningham and Cage and all of their chance procedures. It's like that in a sense, except that it's happening right then and there during the performance rather than before it. So the things that are going on live in the moment are unpredictable to us as the performers because of the nature of how the sort of computer system has been organized. But it's not so much about chance as really trying to get to the sense of technology having a personality, personhood.
Like an emerging with us, this kind of theory of emergence that we have both built the system and it is building
us.
And in response, we're creating something that is unknown or unpredictable.
That's very much, I mean, I think a lot of us now can relate to our experiences with Siri or Google Maps not necessarily telling us exactly the right directions for where to go. And you enter into this weird sort of thing with the technology where you become dependent on it. It seems like a friend, and yet it's telling you to drive down some street that actually isn't the street you need to go down. And so that's a lot of what goes on in this piece.
And how it distances people lying in their bed looking at their iPads or iPhones, and the sense of intimacy. They could be connecting to someone across the world, yet their partner's right next to them. And the way it just changes our sense of distance, time, connection. So we're really interested in the human connection and what technology does
I'm reminded of a dear friend of mine who moved down to San Jose, and I was in my car trying to get to his house, and he said, well, just, you know, use your GPS. No, just tell me what exit to get off. Don't you know how to get to your own home? And no, he didn't.
Right.
He had no idea.
Right, right. Don't you know how to get to your own home? I mean, yeah. I think that's a great metaphor.
It's crazy. So this is on Friday and Saturday at Counterpulse at, at Mission Street.
Saturday, and Sunday.
Sunday, 7 o'clock, yes.
Yeah, great. Information at counterpulse.org. Tell us a little bit more about Smith Wymore Disappearing Act.
Well, we met in Chicago. We went to the same graduate school, University of Illinois, and we met in Chicago. We didn't go to school at the same time, and we started working on various projects together around 2000, but then formed Disappearing Acts in 2004. And we were both have this sense of humor in our work. We have a lot of kind of irony and sarcasm and also have this belief, similar to Mug Woman, that dance is not just, doesn't have to be just dance in its formalistic kind of way of just movement on the stage, which I appreciate and love. But we were really drawn to text and technology. Mm-hmm. We both grew up, you know, having access and working with video, and Sheldon even more so with computing skills. And so it just became this natural evolution to engage on the stage with more kinds of media, more kinds of performance modes. And so we started to grow with the company in that way.
I think both of us were really trained as choreographers and dancers. And I think both of us realized there was something missing in that work. Not that we love that work, but at the same time, feeling like, how come I can't use all the things I'm interested in to create live performance? And so we've just always kept that sort of openness alive. So the piece we're doing now, there's certainly a lot of moving bodies on the stage, but there's a lot of text, interesting computer graphics and sound. And
Sheldon does a lot of his sound composition. He's really interested in music. So we really wanted to create something that we could explore the fullness of who we are as artists.
Right. Well, getting back to this work, Number Zero, without getting too wonky, how is the actual computer program created? Is it a specific program, like off-the-shelf kind of thing, or is it...
It's a little complicated, as one might imagine, but we're collaborating with a friend of ours who's also performing with us, Ian Smith Hesters, and he's much more sophisticated than I am in high-end kind of media programming, and he does everything just in lines of code in
C++. He works with C++.
And I use a program called Isadora, which a lot of theater companies now are using to be able to control and manipulate media in any sort of way you can imagine. And it's almost overly addictive when you start to realize what this stuff can do. And actually, in many respects, that technology has inspired a lot of our work over the years, because it's like, wow, look what happens when I put this together and that thing comes out and I stand in front of it and wave my arms. It's just so like exciting. You can't help but want to build something around it.
Cool.
It's an object-oriented program, and so it's easy to... somewhat easier than having to, say, program all the parts inside of it. It's already kind of modularized, so you can start connecting things together and get immediate kind of responsiveness from the system. So we've always loved that.
Mm-hmm. That's Lisa Wymore with Sheldon Smith. They are Smith Wymore Disappearing Acts. Their work, Number Zero, a Space Opera, will have its premiere on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Each performance will be different, I understand, because of the computer-generated nature of the work. At Counterpulse, you can find out more information at counterpulse.org. Lisa, Sheldon, thanks for taking a little bit of time, and I wish you wonderful performances this weekend.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much
it was fun to be on.
a rabbi who moonlights as a singing drag queen, an Elvis-worshipping witch, the California State Director of American Atheists, a man who found Jesus in the back of a bus. These are just four of the characters you'll meet performed by the single person of Desi Gallegos in God Fights the Plague, playing at the Marsh here in San Francisco through August 10th. It's a work that is several years in the making and comes from Desi's interviews with people from nine different religions. He recreates their words, wisdom, and wit on stage. And he's been working with director-performer Charlie Varon on refining the piece since its inception in 2012. Desi, at the ripe old age of 18, has been writing plays for more than 4 years already and has also taken a hand at directing, herding some 50 young performers as co-director of Sonoma's Cinnabar Theater production of Annie late last year. Desi, such a pleasure to welcome you to Open Air.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Of course. Well, let's first talk about that award-winning play you co-wrote and assistant directed at age 14 called Prop 8 Love Stories. At age 14, what inspired you at age 14 to write about Prop 8?
You know, Brian Bryson has been an incredible mentor to me for many, many years, and he had the idea to do a show, Prop 8 Love Stories. Basically, what the idea was is 16 young actors went out and interviewed 16 couples, gay and straight, about life, love, and discrimination. And then we portrayed all of our interviewees, but it was blind gender casting. Boys would play girls and girls would play guys. So you didn't originally know at the beginning of the show which couples were straight and which were gay, sort of to create the idea, and I believe we succeeded in this, that, you know, love is just love and people are just people. So so it was one of the most positive experiences of my entire life. I know I could not have written my current show, God Fights the Plague, without the experience of doing Prop 8 Love Stories. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a very successful show. We toured around the Bay Area and we went to Off-Broadway and had a short run there. So it was an incredible experience.
That's fantastic. Now, do you find that people of your generation, I mean, 4 years ago at age 14, were they more comfortable talking about sexuality and same-sex coupling? Or was it kind of like pulling teeth and wondering about your own sexuality versus the people of your own age?
It's a great question. I mean, it was a challenge for me at first, you know, even before I started the project. My original reaction when Brian started talking to me about it is, you know, I don't want to do a show like this because people might think I'm gay or something like that. And now looking back, I just look on that as one of the most ridiculous, childish things ever, because who cares, you know? Like, as the show, the message of the show is one that I take completely to heart, and that is, you know, love is just love and people are just people, and gay, straight, it doesn't matter at all.
That's fantastic to have that attitude. I mean, we are in a bit of a bubble here. I don't know if you could get away with that in mid.
That's right. It's probably going to be a little bit tougher in those neighborhoods.
Certainly worth touring, though. My gosh. So let's move on to and appropriately for, you know, this conversation, tonight opens Frameline Film Festival in the case against Eight. The case against Prop 8 is the feature film. We're going to talk about that later in the hour. And moving on tonight. About God Fights the Plague. Now, how did you come up with the title like that?
So originally it started with the idea. I read a book called The Plague by Albert Camus. And basically the idea is a plague is anything irrational and pointless that doesn't make sense. You know, cancer is a plague. War is a plague. Even walking outside and getting hit by a car is a plague. And they're plagues because they don't make sense. There's no real logical explanation for them. They just sort of randomly happen. So the biggest question of my current show, God Fights the Plague at the Marsh, is what can we as rational beings do in a world that is so irrational? How do we respond when plagues come into our lives? And so that was one of the guiding questions as I was going out and interviewing these people. And basically one of the ways I look at religion is, you know, that is a way of handling these plagues of, you know, it's so much more comforting and I think in some ways a beautiful thing where, you know, a plague enters your life, be it cancer or whatever, and you're able to turn to God and you know he's there for you. And that's just one way of doing it, but also there are other ways, you know. Atheism, my atheist tells a story in the show about how, you know, he was on a hike in the middle of the Sierras with his wife, and then he says, you know, and she caught a virus that went to her heart, and she died 7 years ago on a hike in the middle of the Sierras. It was really a shocking kind of an incident, you know. I was trying to give her CPR, and she just died. There was a point where she was trying to hang on and trying to breathe, and then she was just limp. It was pretty obvious what had happened. It was really horrific. But, you know, I basically just kind of accepted it as this is the way things are. And I wound up becoming friendly with a woman who owned a cabin down there near the trailhead. And she invited me, after all the rescue people had come and all that stuff was done, she invited me over to her house with her family. I went over and the first thing they said to me was, oh, Patty's probably hiking in heaven now. And I said, no, we really don't believe in that. I think she's just dead. And that's just the way it is. And then I sort of talked to them about how the most important thing is to make the most out of the time that you have. And so there's a huge variety of perspectives on how to deal with plagues. And so the title, God Fights the Plague, comes from what do we do with that?
So not so much a personal journey of your own quest for a spirituality.
Well, that is definitely in there as well. I would say that there are several, basically... When I started this project, I thought it was just, I was just doing it because I wanted to write a play and because I was interested in religion. I didn't think it had anything to do with my own life. Looking back, I see how ridiculous that was. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer in my sophomore year of high school. My brother is on the autism spectrum and was going through some hard stuff, and I was dealing with some health issues. And so I thought about doing this project, about writing God Fights the Plague, as sort of an escape from all that. And later I realized, you know... It's a huge, like, it's probably the biggest reason, these plagues are probably the biggest reason that I'm doing this project, that I'm writing this play, because I desperately want to find if I can believe in a God or, you know, or reject him once and for all.
Hmm. And how did you ultimately choose the people to interview?
Just a ton of research. I wanted to find the most, you know, inspiring people who had real stories. Like, one of my interviewees... is a rabbi, but also, you know, as you mentioned, is a member of the Kinsey Six, America's favorite dragapella beauty shop quartet. So, you know, he's basically, it's a bunch of people with different perspectives. One of my interviewees used to be a fundamentalist Christian and then fell away from the faith, and now she talks about it. Basically, what she is a therapist for people, in her words, recovering from harmful religion. And so she talks in the show about the psychological effects of what religion does to children and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, I have the fundamentalist, you know, person, fundamentalist Christian who's preaching on the street corner and all that. So there's a huge variety.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you about working with Charlie Varon. I mean, we had him on the air talking about Feisty Old Jew. He's directed other guests that we've had on, the Hoyles. Just he seems to be all over the map.
Yes.
What has he done to help you refine the work?
Before Charlie stepped into the project, I barely had any of my own personal journey in the show. I just basically kept it my interviewees, and Charlie said, no, there's a complete story here. So Charlie really shaped the story of the show, helped me shape the story of the show, and changed the direction of it in so many ways. And I mean, working with him has just been one of the greatest joys of my life, I'd say. He's absolutely brilliant. I mean, there's a reason he's all over, you know, one-man shows in the Bay Area. It's because this is, you know, what he's meant to do, and he's so good at it.
Charlie really is something. Why don't you give us another taste of one of the characters that he helped you refine?
Great. Yeah, this is one of my favorite characters. She's just been talking about how she started to question her faith when her father committed suicide, her cousin got in an automobile accident, and her grandmother died. And so she says, you know, I'd been this radical 1970s feminist, but so there was no way I was going to find spiritual comfort, you know, with a dude. So whether Buddha or Christ, that was just, that was not going to be a go. So I worshipped the goddess. That was that's completely right where I was at. But then I moved on, and now I think that not being monotheistic is being polytheistic. Believing in many different gods is sort of the core tenet of my belief system. But yeah, that was how I became a witch. She's one of my favorites.
That's great. Yeah. And some, I mean, we only have tasted 2 of the 11. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
It's God Fights the Plague at the Marsh. I'm sure you're finding it as you go along each night as well. It must be a different experience.
Yes. I've had 4 performances so far, and I've just been blessed with the audiences, with the response I've gotten. People have come up to me and told me how much it moved them. You know, I've seen people crying in the audience. It's just, I'm so... you know, the opportunity to do this show in such an incredible venue as the Marsh is, I mean, I'm on air all the time, basically. Like, I feel so blessed to have this chance.
That's fantastic. Now, Desi, you're also working for encouraging budding playwrights. I understand that you're working with some kids to on an original play that explores morality, empathy, and innocence. Tell us about Hamlet's Orphans, if you will.
So Hamlet's Orphans began in April. Basically what it is 18 of the most talented young actors and actresses in the Bay Area, in my opinion. We've been getting together once or twice a week and having discussions about what it means to be a good person, what it is to be a kid, and we're not... we've been working from our discussions, improvisations, and games. We are creating and shaping an original play. We're currently rehearsing that 5 days a week, and that opens at the 6th Street Playhouse in July. So, I mean, the experience of working on God Fights the Plague and Hamlet's Orphans at the same time has just been one of the high points of my life. And they're connected in many ways. Both, the point of both really is about... hearing each other's stories, no matter what you believe. I mean, in God Fights the Plague, it's obviously you're hearing the stories of people of all different belief systems. In Hamlet's Orphans, it's about, you know, being able to hear that, you know, kids live lives that aren't always perfectly pretty and happy and all that kind of stuff. It's not going to be a kids' show. It's going to be a show intended primarily for adult audiences, but performed by kids. So, I'm very proud of both of them, for sure.
A lot going on. Boy, and then I have to offer to you some congratulations as well. You're heading to USC this fall as a trustee scholar to study film. Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Desi Gallegos, I wish you a fantastic run at The Marsh as well for God Fights the Plague. It's rang through... August 10th, information at themarsh.org. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Desi Gallegos, a playwright, educator, performer to watch. Wishing him the best. And a perfect segue to our next segment with Desi going off to USC and film school. Well, we're going to talk about Frameline now. The Frameline Film Festival gets underway tonight. KALW, being a proud media sponsor of the festival, now in its 38th year, as the world's longest-running and largest LGBT film festival, Frameline 38 shares transformative stories through groundbreaking documentaries, entertaining features, touching short films, and cinematic classics, with a mission to change the world through the power of queer cinema. Tonight's opening showcase film, The Case Against 8, is a documentary about the unique forces that came together to argue the case against Proposition 8 at the Supreme Court. The screening takes place tonight at 7 at the Castro Theater. Some 800 films from 30 countries were submitted for consideration for this year's festival, and some 65,000 people or so will see the selected films over the next 11 days. Here to talk a bit about the festival is Des Buford, Frameline's Director of Exhibition and Programming, who has been working with on the film festival circuit for some 10 years or so. Des joined Frameline in 2003 and has been involved not only with the Showcase June Festival, but also with the year-round exhibition programs. She was featured in The Advocate's 2012 40 Under 40, a list of influential LGBT figures in media and politics. A pleasure to welcome Des to Open Air.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, boy, it begins, and it begins quite with a bang tonight with this film about the case against 8, something that's still evolving in this country.
That's true. We're so excited to open tonight with the documentary The Case Against 8, which is really a phenomenal behind-the-scenes, all-access account of the epic legal battle to overturn Proposition 8. And it follows the plaintiffs and their legal team for 5 years from San Francisco to the Supreme Court. We're really excited that tonight, all four of the plaintiffs will be joining us. And of course, this is so timely because it's really coming up on the 1 year anniversary of both of those very important SCOTUS decisions.
Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, this thing is still transforming the country. It's an issue that's still evolving, gay marriage, and the case against 8 examines this road to the Supreme Court. And it's very timely, as we're still not quite there yet, what with this weekend's March on Marriage in D.C., for gosh sake. But this film will certainly show us how far we've come.
Absolutely. We're really thrilled to have this in the lineup, as well as another film about marriage equality called Limited Partnership, which looks at a couple that actually got married in the 70s in Colorado and their fight for marriage equality and relationship recognition, which was fascinating history that I didn't know about. So I think we're really coming full circle in the festival in terms of, you know, our histories, our struggles, and our celebrations.
I mentioned to some of the numbers involved in just putting on this festival. Some 214 films will make it into this festival. What has been your particular focus on the festival screenings?
You know, this year we're really, really impressed by the outstanding documentaries. So we're not only opening with a fantastic documentary this year, but we're also really excited to be screening a new documentary called To Be Takei as our centerpiece documentary. And it really celebrates the Star Trek legend, the marriage equality advocate, and the spokesperson for Japanese Americans who were imprisoned in internment camps during World War II, as well as the Facebook phenomenon that is superstar George Takei.
He's
quite remarkable. It's a very personal piece brought to us by local filmmakers, director Jennifer Kroot and editor co-director Bill Weber. And we're also really thrilled that George Takei and his husband Brad will be joining us for the screening on Tuesday night. And we're going to be honoring George with the Frameline Award this year.
Oh, fantastic.
So it should be a very, very special evening.
That screening's Tuesday at 6:30. I should also mention that he also has a small but important scene in Eat With Me, which is screening next Thursday evening. He's quite a character, and we're so glad that he's part of this festival.
Yes, it's such a treat that he'll be joining us, and I can't wait to hear his booming baritone voice in the Castro Theater.
Well, you mentioned George being one of the celebrities that's going to be involved in the festival. Tell us a little bit about some special guests that are expected.
So this year, one of our really exciting special guests is Academy Award-winning actress Monique. She is attending the festival as both a producer and actress with the new film Blackbird, which is based on the novel of the same name. It's about a high school choir boy who really searches to save his soul and amidst the background of the intersection of faith as well as Southern values and African-American culture. She was very moved by this script and decided to come on board the project as a producer as well as an actress. So we're excited to have Monique join us on Sunday evening for Blackbird. We're also thrilled that longtime U.S. House of Representative Barney Frank is going to be attending the festival. There's a new documentary about him aptly titled Compared to What? The Improbable Journey of Barney Frank, which really explores his last year in Congress. He and his husband, Jim Reddy, will also be attending. And we have a new documentary about Olympic diving champion Greg Louganis called Back on Board. It really looks at Greg's amazing diving career as well as kind of the forces at work in terms of homophobia in sports that, you know, perhaps held him back from the success and perhaps monetary success that he really deserved and wasn't able to get, as well as a really fascinating doc called Lady Valor, the Kristen Beck story, which is a documentary about a U.S. Navy SEAL who transitioned from male to female after she left the service. And her name is Kristen Beck, and she has since not only really served the country, but has really come out as a strong face of transgender rights and looking for transgender equality in the military. So we're thrilled that Kristen Beck will be joining us as well.
Fantastic. Are these all considered spotlight films, or are there different things that are considered the spotlight films?
It's a mix of spotlight as well as non-spotlight films. You know, we looked at over 800 submissions this year, and our programming team diligently curated the festival. We do have some spotlight films, and at the same time, every film is really special and merits such amazing content. So we're really thrilled and just blown away by the wealth of our documentaries this year.
It always is a little bit overwhelming when one gets the Frameline booklet in. All details Frameline at frameline.org. That's Des Buford, Frameline's director of exhibition and programming. Boy, you guys must be really excited also that the construction on Castro Street is finished for the most part.
You know, we have very invested members and volunteers, and starting before they even broke ground, people were very concerned about how is this going to affect Frameline? How is this going to affect, you know, my ritual of standing in line? So I know that the team at DPW has been working very diligently, and the sidewalks will be open for our festival as well as Pride.
For those that aren't aware and haven't seen the transformation of Castro Street, they've widened the sidewalks by 6 feet on each side. So it's really going to be our own little corner of Disneyland now, as well it should be. So, Des, what else are you looking forward to this festival?
I'm also really looking forward to a fantastic first feature. It's a Brazilian first feature called The Way He Looks. This was an award-winning film at Berlinale this year. And it's a beautiful coming-of-age story about two best friends who fall in love with the same new boy at school, the twist being that one of them is blind. So it really is a beautiful love story that examines the idea of attraction and what we see in others and how attraction works. It's by Brazilian filmmaker Daniel Ribeiro, and all of the music is by the indie pop group Belle and Sebastian. So it's utterly delightful, and the filmmaker will be joining us from Brazil.
Wow. And there's some parties involved with Frameline as well. One can attend if you go to the website, Frameline.
Yeah, so you can buy tickets. You can download our app. You can buy tickets on our app. So we have a mobile app available on the iTunes Store as well as the Google Play Store for our droids. And all the information and scheduling and whatnot is on our website at frameline.org.
Des Buford, thanks so much for coming in. Next week, I'm pleased to say that we'll be joined by Peter Stein, senior programmer at Frameline, who was for 8 years executive director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, and with Jonathan Taib, director of the feature Stand, a very timely drama about gays in Russia. Thanks again, Des. We'll have you on again.
Thanks, David.
Information, Frameline at frameline.org. Good afternoon, David Latulipe with you for Open Air. Welcoming to the microphone once again, Peter Robinson. Hey, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be back here. And summer is on the way, or summer, in fact, is here, if I've got my season count right. And I'm going to kick off with my what I call a feel-good summer movie, something to cheer your spirits, lift your hearts, entertain your ears, and give you some great visual treats. And the movie is Chef, simply the single word chef, the man in the kitchen who creates food for you. So this is really a combination of a foodie movie, a music movie, a father-son movie, and a roadie movie, and a happy ending movie. So there you go. That makes summer bring a smile to my face. Now, who's at the center of this story? It is Jon Favreau. I'm glad to see that he's back in action again. He is center stage. He wrote it, he directed it, and he plays the key character in it. So you get plenty of him. The supporting cast, and they are much more than supporting, are also people who are going to make you remember the cinema. Dustin Hoffman plays the owner of the restaurant, and the scene opens in a restaurant where the chef cannot cook the dishes he wants to cook, and he is, to add insult to injury, reviewed by a movie critic who then decides that this restaurant is not worth even visiting. And at that point, he cooks the food he wants, and at that point, the restaurant owner fires him. So now he's stuck in the middle, and he goes on the road with his own food truck, and that's really where the story begins. It's a great story. If you like food, you see lots of interesting preparations. But I also mentioned it's a roadie movie, because as it crosses the states from Miami to Los Angeles, we pull into New Orleans, so there is some great music. There's Cuban jazz, there's New Orleans jazz, and then we move on to Austin, Texas, and we're into the blues. So each time we change location, you get a flavor of the city that the, here they go, the Cuban sandwiches are being made.
Very nice.
There are some good close-up shots of culinary events, culinary cooking, particularly inside the van itself. Mm. And two of the other characters I should mention, Scarlett Johansson, she is the girlfriend on the side who clearly has strong feelings for him. And, of course, the person who caught my eye, Sofia Vergara, the Colombian actress, eye candy, a blonde beauty, who really is at the background to the story. Making cameo entrances, both Robert Downey Jr. and Amy Sedaris. So you've got a cast which keeps you on the move, and they all seem to have lives of their own beyond the film. And, of course, we finally end up in Los Angeles with a long, long line for Cuban sandwiches. Here we go. We've now moved from Miami to Los Angeles. But we also see a restoring of the relationship between the father and the son. The son has been allowed to come on the trip during his school holidays, and he's learned how to make real Cuban sandwiches. So when you walk out of the film, hesitate for a moment before you leave your seat. Stay for the credits, because you'll hear some great music and then some tips on cooking at the very end. So I really recommend this as a total family feel-good movie, great music, indeed, some wonderful cooking. You'll probably end up going out and getting yourself a Cuban sandwich. Mm-hmm. And I think to see Jon Favreau back in action again is a treat for all moviegoers.
I was just looking over the cast list. Pretty amazing. John Leguizamo, Bobby Cannavale, you mentioned Scarlett Johansson, Dustin Hoffman also in, Amy Sedaris, Robert Downey Jr. It's going to be fun just to people watch in that film. And you mentioned the Cuban sandwiches. That's a nice tie-in to a concert that's happening this tonight as well as this weekend with the San Francisco Symphony. Michael Tilson Thomas is conducting mid-century masters, including Britten's wonderful Serenade for Tenor, Horn, and Strings, Shostakovich's 15th Symphony, and Copland's Danzón Cubano. So that's my tie-in from the Cuban sandwiches.
Danzón Cubano. There you go.
And then go see the movie after you see the concert. I understand you've also been to the museum, Peter.
Yeah, I have. I've been up to the Legion of Honor, and they have got a wonderful exhibition running. It runs until the 12th of October. It is called Modernism. Just to say a couple of things about the De Young, because it's not known for modern art. It's known traditionally for classical painting from all the different previous periods.
So I'm sorry, is this at the De Young or the Legion of Honor?
Yeah, the De Young. I should have said that. Yeah, thank you for the correction there. And the essence of this is to look at painting from the post-World War II period. They have, in fact, 43 different works of art running in this exhibition. It came from the National Gallery of Art. It's part of the Meinerhof collection. And I think if you're not familiar with modernism, this is a good way to introduce yourself to it, because there is plenty of space. And I say that because some modernist paintings run 15 feet in length, so you have time to move from room to room, and you see essentially the sequence of how this movement developed. And this was particularly instructive to me because I put it in the context of post-World War II, and you wonder after that devastation, and you indeed ask the question, where would art go? And I think this partly answers that question. When I interviewed Harry Cooper, who is the curator who had come from Washington to introduce this exhibition, he gave a very good tip. He said, look for the colours. So you're now looking at colours in abstract about expressionism. And I also asked, if they're so intensely expressionistic, why are they always in square or rectangular frames? Isn't that constricting? And again, I got the same answer. Look for the colours. So I began to get the feel of something which at the beginning, I was frankly insecure about. I liked paintings that told a story. I liked the Impressionists. And now I was moving into this new and different field. It's not, as the experts say, necessarily the best, but these 43 images do give a fair reflection of what's on show. From Jasper Johns to Frank Stella to Roy Lichtenstein. And gradually you see how, if you take your time, the colours, the dimensions, working in 2D and 3D, gradually bring this exhibition to you. One of the great influences on the whole of this movement was the German-born Hans Hofmann. He actually taught at Berkeley prior to the World War II, and they have some of his work, which again are, I think, abstract expressionism really at its best. And part of this movement, and you can see it on the canvas, are the textures that they used, from glue to eggs to to oil, thick floppy brushes which bring really strong strokes. And one room is given over to something which has a title, but you'd be surprised what it is. It's called the Stations of the Cross, but in fact these are vertical paintings, again, this time by Newman, the artist, which really move away from what I call the religious theme, but you're conscious of the suffering. So for an eye-opening exhibition, something slightly different, something which, as I say, the De Jong is not famous for, the new exhibition called Modernism, which runs until October, could very well be an instructive summer treat. And then you can come out and you can take a wonderful walk around the park on a sunny summer afternoon. That's a good way to see the daylight, smell the roses, enjoy the fresh air.
And if you go on a Sunday, you can hear the Golden Gate Park Band starting at 1 o'clock. So you can get a free concert right in that band circle there.
That's right. Music in the Park.
The show is Modernism from the National Gallery of Art, the Robert and Jane Meyerhoff collection, running through October 12th, 2014. You can get a taste of some of the works that are exhibited at the De Jong website. That is deyoung.famsf.org, deyoung.famsf.org. We'll have that link at our website as well. Thanks very much, Peter.
Good to be here, David, and a happy summer to you.
We'll catch you again in a couple weeks, I think.
Okay.
Also, this weekend, in terms of performing arts, I mentioned the San Francisco Symphony performing works of Britten, Shostakovich. The Britten, by the way, is the serenade for tenor, horn, and strings with the marvelous principal French horn player of the symphony, Robert Ward. Toby Spence is the tenor in that work. And then the amazing Symphony No. 15 of Dmitri Shostakovich. Should be a great concert. Tonight at 8, Friday and Saturday at 8. Tickets and information at sfsymphony.org. In addition, this weekend, the Bay Area's trailblazing and internationally acclaimed women's vocal ensemble, Kitka, gives voice to the long-censored love poems of Sophia Parnok, known as Russia's Sappho. In a series of sumptuous and intimate musical settings by award-winning composer Eric Banks, this world premiere concert tells Parnok's story through the poems she wrote to the women she loved. The concert is titled I Will Remember Everything and is co-presented by the Queer Cultural Center for the National Queer Arts Festival with two concerts, the 20th and the 22nd, at St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church in San Francisco. The folks involved with Kitka have been very generous to offer us six pairs of complimentary tickets to this weekend's Kitka performances. To lucky listeners who reach us now at 415-841-4134. Some tickets to Kitka if you make that call now. 415-841-4134 as we listen to a little bit of music of Kitka. Of Kitka. Again, if you'd like tickets, it looks like our lines are full for the complimentary tickets that are being offered from John Hill. Thanks, John, for arranging that. That's about it for open air as well this week. Enjoy Kitka, enjoy the symphony. So much culture happening in KALW land. We're happy to be a part of it. If you've got a feature that you'd like, a group you'd like featured here on open air, drop me an email, david@kalw.org. Suggestions for program are always welcome. A reminder, too, that all of the open-air broadcasts are archived at our website, kalw.org. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week with a whole new batch of cultural offerings here in the Bay Area.